scientism is not science. It's a dangerous and self-refuting philosophy that fixates on means but ignores wisdom.
Dr. Angus Manoogian of the Evangelical Philosophical Society talking about his presentation at the 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
And it leads to the abolition of man, as man is reduced to a material object. It's used as a weapon by atheists and skeptics to attack religion as a source of knowledge. It begins with Bacon's dictum, knowledge is power, but it overlooks the way in which power corrupts.
You can meet and hear Dr. Angus Manoogian making the case against scientism at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 8th and Saturday, June 9th, 15 miles east of St. Louis in Collinsville, Illinois. You'll find a list of speakers, topics, and registration information at issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 8th and 9th in Collinsville, Illinois. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. There was an essay that appeared in the New Yorker a couple days ago by actress Molly Ringwald. If you're an American man of my age, you know her name because you were watching her movies all through your teenage years. A lot of those movies, most of them, were either written, directed, or produced by John Hughes, a now famous and late film director. She wrote an essay in the New Yorker about John Hughes and the films she appeared in and some that she didn't. And it was a mother's perspective. It was reflective. Joining us to respond to that essay, Mark Hemingway, senior writer for the Weekly Standard. He's author of a recent column for The Federalist titled What Molly Ringwald's New Yorker Essay Gets Wrong About Filmmaker John Hughes. Mark, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hey, glad to be back.
Before we get to the critique, what did you find that was commendable about Ringwald's essay in The New Yorker?
Well, I think it was very reflective. I do think it did something that, you know, a lot of people for, you know, decades basically have refused to do with works of popular culture, which is examine them through a moral prism. Now, I might disagree with, you know, the particular approach of how she did that, but I do think it's commendable, and I do think she actually made some accurate moral judgments about the problems of Hughes' films.
Who was John Hughes?
Well, John Hughes started out as a writer for National Lampoon in the 1970s. National Lampoon was famously a humor magazine that produced a lot of famous, say, Saturday Night Live writers and comedians. Some of the better-known writers include P.J. O'Rourke, the famous political humorist, and John Hughes was also on the writing staff there. And Hughes made his, you know, sort of screen debut as the writer of National Lampoon's Vacation, which was, you know, a huge, massive success. I imagine much of your audience has seen that with Chevy Chase. And then pretty much throughout the entire 80s, Hughes was just sort of, you know, unstoppable. For several years there in the 80s, he wrote one film a year, and then he wrote and directed another film. So he basically cranked out two films a year that he was responsible for, and this includes, you know, a lot of what we now consider sort of classics, you know, Pretty in Pink, 16 Candles, Weird Science, The Breakfast Club, Some Kind of Wonderful, Mr. Mom, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, Uncle Buck. You know, you could go on and on.
I mean, Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Ferris Bueller's Day Off, of course, yes. You go on and on. I mean, you know, people, he's quite the output, and it's almost all universally liked and well regarded.
So what in particular did Ringwald highlight in her essay that she was having, I wouldn't call it qualms of conscience, but she was simply saying, as a mother now, especially watching some of these films with her daughter, I'm seeing things that I simply didn't see at the time.
Right.
What kind of things?
Well, the subhead of her essay is revisiting the movies of my youth in the age of Me Too. And she specifically highlights a couple of things. One is there's a scene in The Breakfast Club where one of the boys takes a peek up her skirt in the film, and then there's another scene in 16 Candles where it's implied that sort of this girl who's incapacitated because she had too much to drink spent time with another boy over the course of the evening. And in the age of Me Too, people moved right on from, you know, whether or not this is high school tomfoolery or the fact that boys and girls drinking too much and having, you know, romantic encounters, you know, is a fact of life, you know, to straight from that to, you know, sexual assault and, you know, implied rape. And so, you know, those were certainly concerns of hers that she, you know, dwells on quite a bit. I'd like to think in the context of these films that, you know, these were, you know, again, these are characters within a fictional context and one that's very lighthearted. I mean, I don't think that those things were implied, but, you know, I do understand why, you know, people would be sort of troubled by the implications of those kinds of things portrayed on screen and whether or not that normalizes, you know, aggressive or improper, you know, male sexual behavior.
It is interesting, and that's what I found it intriguing about Ringwald's New Yorker essay when I read it, was to kind of be forced to look back on these films that none of them seemed innocent at the time. I mean, there was nothing innocent about them, but it was kind of a readjusting one's perspective from 2018 back to the 1980s and the 1990s and saying, wow, I don't think those films would even be made today.
Right. No, I mean, I think there's something to that. Although, you know, instinctively, we have this attitude that we have to view everything through the lens of contemporary mores. And, you know, obviously there are some things that, you know, clearly we do evolve on for the better, but it's also true that a lot of, you know, the mores that we take for granted, you know, even now are going to be seen as passing fads 20, 30, you know, years from now. So I think that you have to be very, very careful about, you know, how you assess, perceive, sins, artistic sins in this context, particularly in the current milieu where we're, you know, the Me Too movement that she invokes. I mean, it's also true that, you know, while a lot of, you know, men who are monsters have been brought down by this movement, there's also been a lot of questionable behavior involving accusations being, you know, cavalierly thrown at men that didn't deserve it and, you know, spoiling their reputation. So I am very concerned about the idea of trying to take down John Hughes's, you know, justly beloved reputation through this kind of attitude where, you know, we harp on one or two aspects of this film that we find problematic by our current standards, but ignore all the other good things that were in his films. And that's kind of what I'm concerned about, because in the current moment, this sort of social justice stuff is being, you know, pursued with an almost puritanical zeal. And there's no room for error. You know, if there's one little thing that is, you know, they don't find redeeming, then the whole work is, you know, is wrong.
So you first want to kind of provide a little perspective by way of kind of reminding us of what other films were being made featuring teenagers during the long career, in particular the early career of John Hughes. What are you talking about?
Well, a couple of years ago, I read this book by, he was a former film critic for Spin Magazine. I don't know, I guess it's probably, I don't know how old it is. It's, you know, 15, 20 years ago, but it was called Pretty in Pink. So it's a Pretty in Pink, the Golden Age of Teenage Movies. And it went through all of the teenage films that were made in sort of the late 70s and 80s that were, you know, part of that whole milieu of which John Hughes was kind of the crown jewel. And what's interesting about it is that, you know, John Hughes's films, you know, stand apart for a lot of reasons, not the least of which was that his films were, nobody would call them wholesome, far from it, but the actual, you know, thematic messages were actually quite moral in the end and, you know, sort of very, you know, positive, and especially so when you look at all the other comedies like, you know, Porky's and, you know, Risky Business and all the other things that were much more sort of overtly sexual in ways that weren't redeeming at all. You know, Hughes in particular did something that sort of ran against the current, you know, the thing that made Molly Ringwald famous, is he wrote these incredibly sensitive, fleshed out pictures of characters of teenage girls who were, you know, thoughtful and, you know, not sex objects, which was, you know, very much not what was going on in the 80s. You know, it was all a bunch of, you know, horny boys on spring break, you know, otherwise.
Well, and it gave birth to kind of the next genre of the 2000s, where we had things like American Pie or, well, that probably speaks for everything that needs to be made, and its sequels, which are just nothing but kind of thin plot lines that are constructed to hold up purient jokes.
Exactly. But I mean, I would say, honestly, American Pie is just sort of a continuation of all the other stuff that was going on in the 80s. And it's a classic example of the genre. And we really need to understand that Hughes sort of stood apart from that, you know. I mean, his films took on serious subjects about things like class distinctions, you know, in America, or, you know, National Lampoon's Vacation is sort of an extended commentary on how, you know, American consumer culture just assaults the family and is, you know, offensive to family values. I mean, like, again, the film itself is not wholesome, but the messages are really powerful in terms of when you think about it. And I think that's why, precisely why they're so beloved, because while they sort of indulge the sort of, you know, funny or profane contradictions of American life, ultimately they uphold American values. They uphold, you know, our American sort of, you know, the best aspects of, you know, American, you know, civic Judeo-Christian morality, you know, in the broadest sense. And you don't get a lot of that from, you know, popular culture today, and you weren't getting it, a lot of it, outside of John Hughes and a few other select things in the 1980s. But, you know, now these days, the entire media landscape is so fragmented, and society is so much less, you know, culturally conservative and religious that, you know, basically all bets are off. I mean, it makes John Hughes look like, you know, he was, you know, putting out Kirk Cameron movies or something by, you know, comparison.
Mark Hemingway is our guest senior writer for the Weekly Standard and author of a recent column for The Federalist titled "What Molly Ringwald's New Yorker Essay Gets Wrong About Filmmaker John Hughes." We'll talk a little bit more about that, his eye for talent. He definitely could pick them early, and his view of the family and of country on the other side of this break. We're coming to you live this Tuesday afternoon, April the 10th. Mark Hemingway is our guest, giving response to Molly Ringwald's essay in The New Yorker about director John Hughes.
Well, I think one thing we're going to do right out of the gate is define what pro-life is.
Scott Klusendorf talking about his presentation at the 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
That term is now being confused. It's being put up for grabs, and we're going to make clear what the pro-life syllogism is, how we can make that case for life with people who don't accept biblical authority, who maybe don't even know what it is we stand for, and are subject to being confused. So there's a crying need to clarify what pro-life means, what our actual arguments are, and then we'll look at five bad ways people argue against the pro-life case in the public square so that we can be prepared to give good, solid, Christ-honoring answers.
You can meet and hear Scott Klusendorf making the case for life at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 8th and Saturday, June 9th in Collinsville, Illinois. Learn more about conference speakers and topics and register at issuesetc.org.
We love our on-demand listeners. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Do you find yourself fixing the theology on store-bought greeting cards when you give them to friends and family? Put away that Sharpie. EdGruesome.com has greeting cards, art, jewelry, certificates, church banners, housewares, and all sorts of fantastic gifts that proclaim Christ crucified for us. Whether you're a value shopper or a collector, you'll find something at EdGruesome.com. That's ADCRUCEM.com.
Hey, Todd. What have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore. Thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority, they've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. Thecleaningauthority.com.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Mark Hemingway is our guest on this Tuesday afternoon. His response to actress Molly Ringwald's essay in The New Yorker about director John Hughes. I want to talk a little bit about his by and large, positive view of the family. You had mentioned that Vacation movies, which this poor, hapless dad, all he really wants is just to have a normal, healthy family and all that goes along with it. That's what he wants. But also in... It's something that I think people have noticed about Ferris Bueller's Day Off. There's kind of an arc even, believe it or not, Ferris Bueller has a character arc in there. And I think it's maybe an appreciation that his family actually loves him and cares about him. He has a contrast with his friend who's, I think the whole scene of the expensive sports car going out the garage door has to do with his friend's angst over his father's loving really the car more than him.
Right. No, I mean, very much everything about his films are, you know, sort of exalting his, you know, sort of idyllic upbringing in the Chicago suburbs. I mean, you know, family and, you know, the nice house and yard and everything were, you know, everything, the symbol of everything was great and good about America to John Hughes. And, you know, even when things go haywire like they do in sort of Mr. Mom, where, you know the whole notion of family is sort of, you know, upended as, you know, it's a film about women, you know, in the largest sense, entering the workforce en masse. You know, it's still all about how no matter what happens, you know, things will be okay if we just keep the family unit together. You know, you can just tell that there's this just sort of abiding love for, you know, that sort of, you know, all the sort of, you know, American cliches, you know, that they are, you know, the white picket fences and all those things, you know, are cliches for very healthy reasons. And that's why I said in the essay, I mean, I think that there's a case to say that, you know, that John Hughes is basically the most, you know, America, overtly pro-American filmmaker since Frank Capra. You know, just every one of his films, you know, even, you know, are all about getting to the things in life that are, you know, near and dear to you, and all of the other, you know, aspects of life, you know, be it, you know, faceless bureaucrats in schools or all the, you know, institutional oppression such that it exists, you know, are things that get in the way of the family, things that get in the way of individual freedom that, you know, we're all sort of, you know, wanting to pursue.
Two quick final questions for you, about 30 seconds apiece. He had a knack for picking talent, young talent, that was genuinely mind-blowing.
Right. Well, I think that's honestly, though, but, you know, supposedly the story is, you know, that Ringwald mentions in her essay that he picked her off of, you know, a pile of headshots. And clearly he was looking to represent, you know, American teenagers as fully realized, fleshed-out characters with hopes and dreams and things like that, you know, not these, like, one-dimensional horny screwballs in all the other films that we were, you know, talking about. So I think that really speaks to his character. And when he died, there was actually a famous story of some girl that wrote to him as a fan that he, like, kept up as a teenager, that he kept up correspondence with for, like, 20 years or something. I mean, he really seemed to be a guy that cared about kids.
Finally, then, does your wife, Molly, share your affinity for John Hughes' film? Is it just a guy thing?
I don't think it's just a guy thing at all. I mean, as we pointed out, you know, Molly Ringwald's character, I mean, she was the lead in those three big films. I mean, that was not kind of a normal thing among, you know, teen entertainment, I don't think, at the time, that, you know, the hopes and wants and dreams of, you know, teenage girls were, you know, being catered to that way. And as for whether Molly likes those things, I know she does like them, although I don't know. I, in particular, have a particular obsession with Hughes. I mean, I've always found that there are, you know, sort of, it's the right, you know, we always talk about, as a political journalist, you know, there's a cliche that politics are downstream from culture. You know, I think if we had more healthy cultural examples like Hughes, then it would affect things politically. I mean, you know, Hughes was allegedly a Republican, according to Ben Stein, you know, starred in Ferris Bueller and was a well-known Republican in his own right. And that would make sense. I mean, a lot of the guys coming out of National Lampoons were sort of, you know, counterculture the counterculture and sort of leaned that way, you know, even if they weren't, you know, family values guys. But I don't know. I just think that there aren't many positive cultural examples you can point to that reaffirm your worldview to the right of center in this country anymore that are still revered, and Hughes is one of those.
Mark Hemingway is senior writer for the Weekly Standard, author of a recent column for The Federalist titled What Molly Ringwald's New Yorker Essay Gets Wrong About Filmmaker John Hughes. You can read it and his other columns at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Mark, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thanks again, guys.